This is the Happy Station, broadcasting to North and South America on 9,955 kilohertz from 1 to 155 UTC and from 15 to 1555 UTC.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch rural broadcasting system in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Happy Station presents a tribute to DXers, produced and presented by Keith Perrone.
Hello, everyone. Hello, everywhere. Welcome again to the Happy Station for listeners in North America, Europe, Asia Pacific, Russia, China, everywhere where you're tuning in via different means, either by satellite, AM, FM, shortwave, maybe even longwave, I don't know. And of course, our internet streams. Today's program is going to be another one of our special program of our tribute to DXers. Now, you may remember on June the 4th this year, we did Happy Station's tribute to DXers. Well, we had such an overwhelming response from that first show that I decided to do it again. Plus, there was also a lot of material that we didn't get to use that time, so we use some of it today. So sit back for the next 55 minutes for Happy Station's Tribute to DXers Part 2. Now, is there going to be a Part 3? Well, you just never know. Now, we actually have a lot of things to get to on today's show. We're going to talk about spy number stations. Jerry Berg will be back. And we're going to talk about jamming. But this time, not jamming from China, but jamming in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. But to kick off, here's a group called Days Difference with Radio Song.
I wasted, I regret, it's
Day's Difference and Radio Song beginning today's edition of Happy Station, our special Happy Station tribute to the DXers Part 2. Now, for those who tuned in on June the 4th at 1500 UTC, you may remember on our first DXers tribute, we talked about jamming and jamming from the People's Republic of China. Today we're going to begin the show with jamming, but from a different part of the world, an area where jamming went on for more than 30 years, and that was the former Soviet Union. Ramantas Pilekis was the former Minister of Communications in the Republic of Lithuania in the 1990s, and a longtime DXer. He started listening in the early 1970s to stations like Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, The Voice of America, and many others. Now, since he is a DXer, and jamming was always very interested to him as well, he decided to write a book. The book is called Jamming. It's 164 pages and includes all kinds of information, which is absolutely fascinating. There's photographs of the jamming sites, the master control rooms, the technicians who work there, technical data sheets, and much, much more. So I decided to give him a call up and to have a conversation with him about jamming in the former Soviet Union and in the Eastern Bloc at that time. My first question to him was, how much of the jamming done in Lithuania was controlled by the Lithuanian officials?
I cannot say that it was a Lithuanian activity to jam the foreign radio broadcasting. Okay, well, all commands came from Moscow, and the All Union Ministry of Communications was responsible for the jamming operations. And in Lithuania, in a small country, there were five local low-power jamming stations in all five biggest cities of Lithuania, with totally roughly about 50 or 60 low-power jamming transmitters ranging from 1 kilowatt to 5 kilowatts. So I must say that was a Soviet operation. But some components of the jamming system were located in Lithuania as well.
Now, with the jamming, was it very effective? Because during that period when there was a lot of jamming going on, broadcasters, let's say like Radio Liberty and Voice of America, would just add new frequencies. So there was more and more frequencies and more jamming. But was all the jamming effective?
Yes, the jamming was quite effective, but everything depended on where you are located. For example, I started to listen to foreign radio stations since 1972, when I was living in a small southern Lithuanian town, Druskininkai, okay? And the nearest jamming stations were roughly 100 or 120 kilometers away. So at that time, when this place was not covered by the skywave jammers, which were located far away, a couple of hours per day it was possible to listen to such programs as Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, BBC, Deutsche Welle, and others. And in the late 70s, the Soviet Union jammed seven main foreign radio stations. The most intensive jamming was targeted against Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, also against Voice of America in Russian and other languages, against the British Broadcasting Corporation and Deutsche Welle. But also we had jamming of the Voice of Israel programs, of Radio Tirana programs, and of Radio Beijing programs. But for separate stations, the Soviets used the different jamming signals.
Lithuania is a relatively very small country. When jamming was occurring, was jamming targeted mainly for Vilnius, or was the jamming nationwide?
The jamming system consisted of two main components. One component was so-called Skywave, or long-distance high-power jamming stations, and in the late 70s there were 13 such big Skywave jamming centers all over the Soviet Union, and in these 13 Skywave jamming centers there were approximately 100 or more high-power transmitters, ranging from 100 kilowatts to 200 kilowatts or more. And additionally, there was another network of so-called low-power or ground-wave jammers, which were intended to block the biggest cities. So in the late 70s, there were such jamming facilities were installed in 81 cities of the former Soviet Union. And of those all jamming transmitters, we had five jamming stations in Lithuania alone. And the effective range of such low power and ground wave jammers was approximately between 20 and 30 kilometers away. So my small town was more than 100 kilometers away from the nearest jammers, and therefore at certain hours I was lucky to listen to some foreign radio stations.
The jamming, for example, that is done by China, they're either broadcasting China National Radio on for co-channel interference, and they're also broadcasting this traditional Chinese music, which a lot of DXers have called Fire Drake. What about in the Soviet Union and Lithuania?
At that time, there were two jamming signals. One of them was a so-called noise generator, which produced a very intensive and strong noise, electronic noise. And another type of audio jamming of the jamming signal was a distorted program of the Radio Mayak. The noise jamming was targeted against Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and also against Radio Tirana, and against Voice of Israel. And other stations, VOA, BBC, Deutsche Welle, and Radio Beijing, were jammed with the Radio Mayak program. This program was transmitted in FM mode. Therefore, when I listened to these stations with a simple, normal AM receiver, AM shortwave receiver in the analog modulation, the Mayak program sounded very distorted, so it was quite annoying. But it was a political decision to use separate different jamming signals, because according to the Soviet propaganda standards, the most anti-Soviet stations were Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the Voice of Israel, and Radio Tirana. Therefore, the Soviets used a noise jamming against these stations. And other stations were mostly state-run and state-owned, like the VOA or BBC or Deutsche Welle. Therefore, another jamming audio signal was used to jam these stations.
Was this an open secret? For example, with China, I have asked government officials about jamming, and they keep saying, no, we don't jam international broadcasters, but everybody knows they do. What was the reaction, for example, let's say in Lithuania or the Soviet Union, if the question was asked by foreign media, oh, are you jamming international broadcasters? What would the reply normally be?
In the early 50s or in the 60s, the Soviet Union told to anybody that we are not jamming the foreign radio program. But in the 70s and 80s, they had another explanation that, yes, we are jamming and we have a right to jam. We have a right to defend our nations from the hostile, very angry anti-Soviet propaganda. So they told that they have a right to jam the foreign radio program.
Now, after the political system in that part of the world changed, did the jammers go off just offline at that moment, or was it around the time when Mikhail Gorbachev introduced glasnost that they started to reduce jamming?
I can say and remember that the last jamming targets were Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. They transmitted programs in maybe 15 or 17 languages of the former Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. First of all, in Russian language, in Belarusian, in Ukrainian, and many other. Radio Free Europe transmitted also in the languages of the Baltic states, in Lithuanian, Latvian, and Estonian. And this station was... the Soviet Union stopped to jam the RFPRL programs on the 30th of November of 1988. That was the last station which was jammed by the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And jamming of the Voice of America programs and of the BBC programs and of the Deutsche Welle programs was stopped 1 or 2 years earlier. Because RFPRL was the most, well, critical to the Soviet regime, and therefore it is my opinion that Kremlin and Moscow was afraid most of all of the RFRL programs.
Now, when the jamming stopped, what happened to these jamming sites? Did they just turn them into regular shortwave transmission sites, or did they dismantle them completely?
Mostly the high-power skywave jamming centers were used for the ordinary radio broadcasting, and they could transmit Radio Moscow's program to another continent and to another countries, and they used these capacities just for normal shortwave broadcasting. In other cases, the local ground-wave jammers, which typically used low-power transmitters, 1 kilowatt or 5 kilowatt power, and most of these stations were dismantled, and only few of them were converted for broadcasting of the radio programs for the local population.
Did the Soviet Union make a lot of technical advances in jamming that are, let's say, being used by the North Koreans, Cuba, and China today?
The jamming system was quite similar all the times. The main issue is to gather as much power as possible, and also directional antennas, and it is necessary to have a good monitoring system to check the jamming targets. So the system was the same 20 years ago, 10 years ago, and even now. But of course now some countries like China, they have a lot of money, and they buy the newest up to 500 kilowatt transmitters, for example, made by Thales in France with a directional ALIS type antennas, rotatable antennas, and they have a hell of such stations, many dozen transmitters, and we can now hear in Lithuania the Chinese jamming, which was earlier almost entirely made from Chinese instrumental folk music, and now they changed, and they mostly transmit Radio Beijing programs.
The money that must have been spent by the Soviet Union and also the Lithuanian government at the time must have been extremely high, which makes me ask the question, after the political system changed and new government leaders took over, was there ever an investigation done about the jamming that had been done, an investigation done by the new government themselves?
I know the only serious study of jamming, which was written by the Czech historian Prokop Tomek, and it is a nice article, big article with a lot of facts, including money, equipment, frequencies, and all things about jamming in the former Czechoslovakia. So that is the only known big, serious, and important article. Unfortunately, I don't know any other studies which could be made in in other countries like Poland or Bulgaria or the Soviet Union. So at least now we have only one scientific article about jamming in the former Czechoslovakia, written by Prokop Tomek.
Right.
And of course, I hope that there are still documents in the archives, but it is my understanding that the local scientists in Poland or in Bulgaria or in the Eastern Germany or in the former Soviet Union in Russia, they must work in the local archives of Warsaw, of Sofia, of East Berlin, and of Moscow, because it is difficult to do serious investigation being not in the in the country.
Now, with jamming, when all the sites were dismantled, did any of the countries, for example, like Russia, for example, did they keep any sites operational, which could at a moment be turned on again for jamming in case the political situation had changes?
Yes, well, I know the situation in the former Soviet Union, and now in Russia there are many radio centers, not all, but some of them, which still exist, and they can be used for jamming. But jamming now has another, radio censorship now has another forms. For example, well, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, Radio Liberty had more than 30 local relay stations, affiliated stations, as they call them, mm-hmm. in Russia, which were transmitting Radio Liberty's program in Russian language and in other languages on the local FM networks, on the local AM transmitters and cable radio networks. And now what we have is that only maybe 15 of these stations still exist, and the Russian authorities are pressing the private broadcasters not to rebroadcast, not to relay the Radio Liberty's program. Until now, there are no signs that Russia is blocking the foreign radio programs on the internet, but we see many such cases in such countries like Iran and China. But also we see many cases, or at least several cases, of the satellite jamming. Some cases were reported in Cuba, in Iran, in China. So now we have internet filtering, now we have satellite TV and radio jamming, and it is difficult to make any prognosis about future of international radio broadcasting, but if the digital broadcasting DRM system will break through, then this long-distance broadcasting can be very important again, because sometimes it is easier technically and financially to block the satellite broadcast or to filter the internet, but it is difficult to block the entire territory of the big countries like China or Russia to block out the incoming radio signals.
Mm-hmm.
So if the DRM system will be implemented in the world, so then the shortwave broadcasting can be important again. And who knows what will happen with jamming, because the Russian regime is getting worse and worse every year, and let's see.
And I was speaking there with Rimantas Perikis, the former Minister of Communications in Lithuania in the 1990s. He has a website called radiojamming.info. That's www.radiojamming.info. And the website is available in five languages, and you can find some photographs, some sound recordings, as well as information on how to order his book called Jamming, as well as a DVD that he produced called Empire of Noise. You're listening to a special edition of The Happy Station for listeners around the world, Happy Station's Tribute to DXers, Part 2.
The British DX Club is one of the world's leading DX clubs, with hundreds of members both in the UK and around the globe. BDXE produce a comprehensive monthly magazine called Communication, covering all aspects of the DXing hobby. The BDXE Audio Circle is also available and is a monthly program of DX catches and general chat about radio. For more information, please write to the British DX Club, 10 Hemdean Hill, Caversham, Reading, RG4 7SB in the United Kingdom, or visit the website at www.bdxc.org.uk. That's www.bdxc.org.uk.
Well, one thing about radio that I happen to enjoy, and I suppose a lot of other people enjoy as well, are radio anecdotes. Some funny stories that happen behind the microphone, not just sitting behind it, but behind the glass, in the control room, the corridors, newsrooms, and music departments of radio stations around the world. Now, on our first show, one of my former colleagues from China Radio International, Stuart Parkins, came on to tell us a funny story about dealing with the censors at China Radio International. Now, Stuart has many of these stories as he spent over 10 years at CRI. So while we recorded that one that we used on June 4th, I said, Stuart, just record as many as you want because I know they're rather funny and the listeners would love them. So here's Stuart Parkinson again, talking about, well, a funny anecdote within CRI that involves losing extremities. What do I mean by that? Well, let's listen in. Stuart?
It was one of the earlier cooking shows, and I often included a bit of advice on how to keep your kitchen tools working properly. And I started off, before we start, I'm going to chop up some beef bones to make a wonderful stock. But you must always, when chopping bones, have a very sharp cleaver, because if it's not sharp, it can bounce off the bone and go through your finger or worse. And anyway, I haven't had time to sharpen my cleaver, so never mind, we'll chop away. So I started chopping, bang, 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 and I dropped a tomato or something in a bowl of water. And the timing was, it was pure luck. It was perfect. It was just like I chopped my thumb off and it plopped into the stock, beef stock. Oh my God, that's painful. Never mind. My thumb's in the stock. It'll taste better. But I'll go to the hospital after the show. The show must go on. Right. And I've continued the show. And again, it was probably that afternoon or later that morning, I'm not sure. The same two lovely, lovely old women. Mr. Parkins, we heard that you hurt your hand very badly when you were doing the cooking show. And as luck would have it, I think I had one hand in my pocket or hidden. I said, yeah, but that's okay. I went to the hospital and they bandaged it up. And it's just my thumb, you know, I can get away with. Oh, that's terrible. They believed it. I mean, it just didn't occur to them that I'm not going to chop my thumb off in a studio. And if I did, I would certainly get to the hospital very, very quickly with my thumb in ice. But that didn't occur to them. It was on the radio, therefore it's true. The idea of humor, it just didn't enter into their minds. And that was another example, which is quite amusing.
You know, Stuart, as I was listening to you, for some reason, I don't know what happened, but it all came back to me, the times that I had to have very odd conversations with the censors at China Radio International. And Stuart, of course, will be back at some point in the future with some funny inside stories of the happenings within CRI. You're listening to a special edition of The Happy Station, Happy Station's Tribute to DXers Part 2. Now, on the show, you may have heard me mention a few times that here in the studio, for some reason, it's either the microphone or some other piece of equipment that's picking up radio signals. And it's been happening again today. So I asked Kevin, Kevin, can you put the volume up a bit? Because I'd like people to hear this annoying noise that we keep hearing now and again.
Three, nine, seven, one, five. Mr. Peron of HX6, we have discovered the coded message you're broadcasting through Happy Station. So, 00, what's your choice? Hand the radio and codebook over, or have them surgically removed using whip antennas and tuning knobs?
Well, of course, that wasn't the kind of interference that we're picking up. That was just our segue into our next segment on the show, and that is Spy Number Stations. Simon Mason, who has been writing about the subject for a number of years, he has a website, which is www.simonmason.caroo, that's K-A-R-O-O.net, is rather an expert on the subject. He's appeared on a number of BBC programs to talk about the history of spy number stations and everything else. So I decided to give him a call up to find out about this mystery, which most DXers and most average shortwave listeners have heard time and time again. Just an announcer reading 5, 5, 3, 2, Alpha, Bravo in a monotone voice or whatever, to tell us a bit more about how he found these stations himself and how he got interested in number stations.
I was a teenager in the early 1970s, and in those days, before the internet, before multi-channel television, you only had 3 TV channels in the UK. So getting the international news or to get any news from behind the Iron Curtains, I was there. I used to love listening to Radio Moscow and stations like that, and Voice of America. So I was just tuning around like yourself, and gradually you go outside of the broadcast bands to look for new things to listen to. So I'd listen to shipping as well. There was a lot of shipping on shortwave in those days, and of course aircraft. And then you stumble upon the radio amateur bands, listening to radio hams talking to each other around the world. And as you're doing that, I came across, like yourself, number stations, tuned into them, and in those days, there was nobody who had a clue what they were. There were no magazines that mentioned them. And if you talked to anybody in the radio business, like radio amateurs, who know the way around the shortwave bands, they assumed it was something like weather forecasts. So, I just stumbled upon them much like itself.
When did the information start coming out that these, in fact, were from intelligence services?
Well, personally, I think it was, I was in a Hull City library. I live in a city called Hull in northeast England. And I was in their main library. I just happened to stumble upon a book called The Radio Hackers Guidebook or something. And buried in there, it mentioned that these transmissions were meant for espionage agents in foreign countries. I mentioned a magazine called Popular Communications, which is a United States publication, and also Monitoring Times. They're both US publications that are still running today, I think. So I subscribed to them and found out there were a handful of DXs in the United States that I wasn't aware of who were actively monitoring these things. In the UK, we had a magazine called Shortwave Magazine, but because of the restrictions of the UK radio listening laws, you can only listen to broadcast stations and radio hams. So Shortwave Magazine itself didn't discuss number stations or pirate radio stations because they were illegal in this country. But in the United States, there was an active forum of people that used to listen to number stations and report them and have them published in these magazines. So it would be around 1987 that I found out that there were messages to spies.
You see, a lot of people who've never heard them before would say, why would intelligence agencies use something as old-fashioned as shortwave to send messages to agents overseas?
Well, it's because the main reason is security. Because if you imagine, how do you get a message to a spy that you've spent years and years getting into a position where they can pass you on to your secrets or information? You have to spend years cultivating these people, and the last thing you want to do is to expose them to the police or the authorities. So if you imagine that someone sent you a letter with the information, then a letter can be intercepted quite easily. Someone in the household could steam it open and read it, or the person could read it. So security is compromised. Similarly, if you ring someone's phone and call them that way, then the phone can be phone call can be intercepted by the authorities. Emails can be intercepted. Face-to-face is also risky because someone might be followed. So for security purposes, a number station transmission over shortwave is ideal because the signal could literally be for 6 billion people around the world. There's no way of tracing the recipient. So you have a single transmitter somewhere, say in Russia or in one case on the island of Cyprus, and the spies themselves could be thousands of miles away, and all they need is a bit of paper with some numbers on it and get the message through. And if anyone happens to raid the house or the housekeeper's looking around doing some dusting or cleaning up, all they find is a radio there, which nearly everyone in the world has, so there's no compromising pieces of evidence there.
Mm-hmm. I also suppose at the same time, because the technology is so simple, nobody would even bat an eye if somebody was listening to a shortwave radio.
Well, that's correct, yeah. They'd bat an eye if they heard the numbers rather than the same music or sports. But usually you would use a pair of headphones so that, say, the next-door neighbours wouldn't hear the transmission. But as I say, the only incriminating piece of kit you have is the radio that nearly everyone has.
Now, with the number stations, are there any cases in the past or even today where the number stations, for example, it could be an actual program that was being transmitted on any international broadcaster, and within that program there was coded messages in the music or in the news bulletin? Has that ever been discovered?
Not officially, but I believe that such transmissions used to happen during the Second World War, where BBC stations would have not encrypted messages, but special phrases or catchwords that they'd use within a broadcast that were meant for people in German-occupied Europe. But, of course, in this day and age, an organisation like the BBC would have to distance itself from any connection with, say, MI6 or CIA, and also the Voice of America and NBC and CBS would have to keep a distance from the CIA. So you can't get public broadcasters such as now Sky or BBC getting involved in espionage activities from their transmitter sites because the political repercussions would be so enormous.
Now, there was an interesting one that I heard that some people had written to one of the Czech number stations and actually got QSL verification cards back.
Yeah, sure, I've got one myself.
That is very unusual.
It is. Well, in the number station, well, it's unique. So I tried the same thing with Lincolnshire Poacher and didn't get any reply. But so this was astonishing to get a QSL card, a verification card, from a number station. And it was from the Ministry of the Interior in Prague when it was Czechoslovakia. So it was one of their transmissions. So, yeah, that is actually something that I treasure, is a QSL card from a number station.
Now, through the years that shortwave listeners, DXers, and people that have started groups and clubs to follow number stations, has it ever happened in the past that either one of two things? Number one, a government official accidentally let something slip to the media? Or has it ever happened that people that do monitor these groups that have started internet pages and newsletters, have they ever been approached to say, you know, you shouldn't do this?
No. Well, I mean, I personally had a website on the subject for, I think, about 12 years, where I've got hundreds of recordings and hundreds of links and information, and also the book that I had published in the early 1990s called Secret Signals. That's online for people to read. And in all that time, I've not had a single message or phone call or letter from any official telling me that I shouldn't be doing it, because they can't have it both ways. They can't say, well, these transmissions, we don't know what they are, and then come along to me and say you shouldn't be writing about non-existent stations that we don't operate.
And I was speaking there with Simon Mason, a well-known expert who's been on a number of radio programs to talk about spy number stations. His website again is www.simonmason.karoo.net. All right, now a few weeks ago on the show, my guest was Jerry Berg. Now, Jerry has written three books on international broadcasting. The first one was called On the Short Waves, 1923 to 1945. And the second one, Listening on the Short Waves, 1945 to today. And then the third book called Broadcasting on the Short Waves, 1945 to today. Now, Jerry is a well-respected shortwave listener and expert on international shortwave broadcasting. The three books, by the way, are available from McFarland Publishing, their website I'll give out at the end of the show. But then let's move on to the remainder of the conversation that I had with Jerry. And I wanted to ask him at one point about the golden age, because we hear about, for example, the golden age of cinema, the golden age of television, and there's also a golden age of radio. But what about the golden age of shortwave radio?
I think there are sort of two golden ages, I guess. There are some people who would say that the golden age was really the 1930s, when shortwave was just coming into its own, and some people had great hopes for shortwave. People thought that it was going to replace medium wave broadcasting altogether, and that listening to international shortwave was going to become commonplace. That never happened, of course, but there was a good deal of hope back then. In more modern times, yeah, I would say the golden age of shortwave was probably the 1970s. By that time, we were long out of the experimental period. Stations were coming on the air right and left. There were tons of stations in South America and Indonesia and all kinds of out-of-the-way places. And none of the big broadcasters had started cutting back yet. And so mm-hmm. in terms of how much there was to listen to and how interesting it was, yeah, I would say that was sort of the second golden age.
Would you say, I mean, in your own personal view, the difficulty that, let's say, shortwave has had, especially in the last maybe 20 years, was bad promotion of shortwave as a viable broadcast medium?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. There are a lot of people that are always sort of puzzling about why things are the way they are. I don't know if it was bad promotion, although there certainly was bad promotion. Really, there was very little promotion. One of the realities of international shortwave broadcasting is that most of these services are really, really very low budget, with a few exceptions, are very low budget shoestring kinds of operations, and they're not driven by the same kind of commercial dynamics that private radio stations are. So that has always been a problem. But you know, the reality is that shortwave has really, I won't say always been an invisible medium, but for a very long time it's been an invisible medium. And there are some folks who feel that if you only talk it up and get people interested in it and tell them what's on shortwave, they would find it interesting and more people would listen. But somehow it's just never worked that way. So I don't know that you can lay it principally at the feet of those who weren't promoting shortwave, but there's no question that there really wasn't much promotion, and whatever advantages might have been gained by increased promotion were never realized.
Something about international broadcasting that I always found very fascinating, and you talk about him in your book, is a well-known Voice of America broadcaster by the name of Willis Conover.
Yeah.
And, you know, it amazes me. I've talked to Americans who work in the jazz industry who had never heard of him. But on a few occasions when I've been to Eastern Europe and I've mentioned to people the name Willis Conover, he was like a celebrity almost.
Yeah, it's really a testament to, the power of shortwave, that you could have a shortwave personality that could have that kind of impact in such a broad part of the world, while at the same time being completely unknown here in the United States. It's a good example.
So when you finish book two, Was that, did you say to yourself, okay, that's the end of it, I've done two, I've covered everything I can. Then you wrote the third one. What happened?
Well, actually, broadcasting and listening were written at about the same time. They were released at the same time. So as I was writing one, I was also working on the other. The broadcasting book, which is largely a year-by-year presentation of what was on the air, I thought was necessary because there really wasn't anything like it available. And my own view was that once shortwave had, I don't want to say disappeared, but once it had gotten to the point where really only the most devoted people were listening to it, there would be no record of what had gone before. And that's why I wrote the broadcasting book. It wasn't intended to be an exhaustive treatment of every station that was on the air and their respective histories. It was intended to be, and I think it is, a pretty good picture of what you could hear on shortwave each year from 1945 on. Whether you are interested in international broadcasting or interested in DXing the smaller stations, it just seemed to me that there ought to be a record of this. And so that's why I put that together.
You know, the other thing that I find quite fascinating is, of all broadcast mediums, it seems that shortwave has gone through probably the biggest change, even more so than medium wave or FM or digital audio broadcasting. But shortwave itself, I mean, when you think today in 2009, it is nothing even it's nothing compared to what it was 20 years ago, let alone even 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. There's no question about it. It's viewed now, unfortunately, as a legacy system, a legacy technology, although one that gets pressed into service when other things tend to fail. And yet, at the same time, there are people who are trying to improve it. The whole digital shortwave movement, although it hasn't taken off to the degree that some folks would have liked, is kind of interesting because it brings the notion of FM quality or high fidelity quality reception to shortwave. That's something that, of course, could never have been imagined not too many years ago.
You know, I heard a quote recently from someone, and he said to me that if shortwave had been invented now, this year, he said people would be going gaga over it to think that you can have a transmitter in one country and reach another country, but because it's from the Marconi era, about 100 years ago, it's considered outdated old technology.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, the magic of shortwave has never really been, at least for sort of the devoted shortwave listener, the magic of shortwave has never really been on the program side. It has always been on the side of the medium. The notion that you can turn on your shortwave receiver and hear a station from the other side of the world with nothing between you and them except for the ionosphere, it is really quite remarkable. And of course, that's different from using the internet, where you can get, you know, crystal clear programming now from virtually any place in the world. But you're connected by wires, so you kind of expect that quality of program. But in shortwave, it's kind of the magic of the distance, I think, that really has kept shortwave listeners interested over the years.
Would you say then that this could be a transitional period for shortwave radio, that we're right now we're in this period of where the media is going from what it was to almost disappearing to coming back in some way, shape, or form?
Oh, for sure. The form that it's coming back into or morphing into is leased time broadcasting. I mean, the number of new radio stations that come on the air today, new shortwave stations, is very small. If you define a shortwave station as a transmitter and some program production capability, what organizations do now, if they want to use shortwave, is that they rent time over one of the big international broadcasters, BBC, Germany. There are a variety of transmitter sites around the world that essentially broker their time. They sell their time to most anybody that is interested in buying it. So as a result, you know, you can be a small organization with not much more than a tape recorder and not too much money in the bank, and you can buy time through one of these big transmitter houses, and you can put your signal out worldwide. Whereas if you had to develop your own transmitting capability, which used to be the rule, there would be no way that you could get on the air. So as a result, you have a lot of sort of different kinds of organizations coming on shortwave. They're not typically broadcasting all day or for many hours a day. Oftentimes they're only an hour or two a week or something like that. But nonetheless, they're interesting. They're interesting programmatic targets, even though they may not constitute real DX to shortwave listeners who are looking for that. So that's the way things have gone. And it may well be that there's enough of that business to keep, you know, a small number of high-power transmitter operators in business. But I certainly don't see any trend back to the good old days, so to speak, when it was new stations with new transmitters. Those days seem to be over.
And I was speaking there with Jerry Berg, the author of three books on the shortwaves, 1923 to 1945, Listening on the Shortwaves, 1945 to today, and Broadcasting on the Shortwaves, 1945 to today. The books are available from McFarland Publishing. Their website is www.mcfarlandpub.com. That's mcfarlandpub.com. And I will be giving away a copy of all three books to one lucky listener in the future for an upcoming Happy Station contest. All right, well, that's all we have time for on this Happy Station Tribute to the DXers part two, that is. And some of you are wondering, is there going to be a part three? Well, that's all I'm going to say right now. Well, and that's it. Nothing more. You have to tune in to find out. Anyway, that's all we have time for. So until next week, friends, this is Keith Perron all the way in Taipei, Taiwan, wishing you well, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
This is the Happy Station, broadcasting to North and South America on 9,955 kilohertz from 1 to 155 UTC and from 15 to 1555 UTC. This is the Happy Station, broadcasting to North and South America on 9,955 kilohertz from 1 to 155 UTC and from 15 to 1555 UTC.